This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello and welcome to Talking Turkey. I'm your host, Ahval editor David Lepeska, and with me today is a returning guest, Alexander Clarkson, a lecturer on German and European studies at King's College London. Hello, Alex, and thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, David.
We are speaking on Monday, the 6th of July, a few days before the European Parliament is set to examine Turkey's negative role, or what it perceives as Turkey's negative role in the Eastern Mediterranean, in particular a June 10 maritime confrontation in which a Turkish warship thought to be carrying arms to Libya refused to allow a French frigate and a Greek ship to carry out mandatory inspections as part of a NATO and United Nations arms embargo on Libya. France says the Turkish vessel pointed its prow toward the French ship in a clear act of maritime aggression, while Turkey has denied any wrongdoing. French President Emmanuel Macron said Ankara's actions were criminal and put European security at risk. In Libya, Turkey has given significant military backing to the Tripoli-based Government of National Accord, or GNA, in its fight against General Khalifa Haftar's Libyan National Army, which is supported by Russia, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and, of course, France. Alex, what do you think the European Parliament might decide to do about Turkey's actions, if anything? Recent EU and NATO responses to Turkish aggressions in Libya and the East Med have been widely seen as toothless.
I think I don't think the European Parliament will do anything much about anything related to Libya. Particularly in terms of this particular incident. And there's a number of different reasons for that. I mean, the first is that in some ways, Paris is increasingly isolated. Well, not isolated goes a little bit far, but Paris is finding it difficult to gain the kind of support it might have been able to get a few months ago about Libya or East Med-related policy when it comes to dealing with the Turkish case, particularly when it comes to such issues as trying to halt or roll back to Turkey's expanded role in the Libyan theater, partly because the Italians are back, not in the extent they were under Minniti. I mean, in the under the PD government of the mid-2010s, Italy developed quite an ambitious policy towards Libya, really quite strategic policy. It helped build the GNA. It played a central role in all kinds of local deals that brought that kind of that the whole GNA structures, General Government of National Accord structures together, which Turkey is now supporting. It built a substantial military and covert presence in quite large, substantial parts of western Libya and Fezzan, in southern Libya, but partly because of the internal chaos of Italian politics in the summer of 2019, partly because of the offensive by Haftar and the LNA factions against the GNR in April 2019 completely blew away the foundations of Italian strategy. The Italians' strategy fell apart, and they only really recovered in the last couple of months and have been far less ambitious. But that means they need deals with the Turks, right? That means they need to have negotiations and engagement and deals with Ankara to reassert their local interests in various places, because Italy is the main, if not the primary, oil and gas market for Libya and has enormous kind of economic interests there. The same goes on a kind of lesser scale with Malta as well. So already you have two EU members that have an interest in not confronting Ankara frontally over what's happening. And you can see this. I mean, the Maltese government welcomed Sarraj, who's the head of the GNA government, I think this morning, or I think yesterday evening, to Valletta. The Italian government has visited Di Maio, the Italian foreign minister, visited Ankara, I think, a week ago. There's a lot of consultation going back and forth. So I think what you see with Malta and Italy in particular is they're trying to separate the Libya issue from the East Med issue. So the issues around Cyprus, I mean, if Turkey continues in confrontational course in the waters around Cyprus or Crete in terms of drillings, you'll actually see, I think, some robust European engagement, because there you can get all the EU member states together in terms of position against Ankara to support Greece and Cyprus, though maybe not as much as Cyprus hopes. But what you're going to see, I think, is an attempt by Italy and Malta to sort of decouple that from the issues around Libya, even though Ankara is trying to link the two through its memorandum of understanding.
So let me just link those two. The Libya conflict also connects to these tensions in the Eastern Mediterranean because Turkey signed this maritime borders deal with the GNA late last year that essentially erased the island of Crete from the map. And Ankara has announced plans to begin drilling off the Libyan coast and possibly in the area of Crete. And it's already begun some drilling operations around Cyprus. And all this has sparked the ire of Athens and Cyprus and other EU states with energy interests in the area. So it's interesting that you say that Malta and Italy and perhaps others are looking to decouple it, because to Turkey and to many others, they are closely linked, these two issues, Libya and the Eastern Mediterranean.
I think that's partly to Ankara's advantage. I mean, when I spoke with you last time, I saw Turkey, I thought, was engaging a form of anti-diplomacy. Now, if we go a bit further into the conversation, I still think Turkey, in the long term, and even the medium term, is not in as strong a position towards the EU as it believes, and might have to actually have a bit of a reckoning on those terms, but not necessarily in these fields. But in terms of the specifics of the East Med, I mean, it's now at the short term, an advantageous position has emerged because the Italians, because Ankara, I think in some ways because Turkey was more successful than even Ankara expected in its counteroffensive against the LNA, against this sort of faction in Libya against which it's opposed, that's opposed to the GNA government that Turkey's backs. I think even to Ankara, I think even the Turks to an extent were surprised by the extent of success they had in pushing the LNA out of Western Libya. And that, of course, creates facts on the ground that the Italians and Maltese have to deal with. These are the two countries that are closest to Tripolitania, to this western part of Libya. Italy has, as I said, substantial economic oil and gas and oil interests and security border control interests with the GNA. It has long-standing relationships with the GNA that sort of fell apart in the September of 2019, which is one of the reasons why the GNA was so open to approach by Turkey. The GNA leadership didn't necessarily only go to Ankara, but when they went to Rome, the Italians were basically paralyzed. The leadership, parts of the leadership that they'd worked with under Interior Minister Minniti weren't there anymore because PD was out of government and only returned in August, September 2019, returned to government in Italy. So their partners on the Italian side weren't necessarily there. On the political level, a lot of Italian officials in the Ministry of Defense and Ministry of Interior and Ministry of Foreign Affairs were, as a result, very frustrated because of the lack of any clear signal from their political leadership. So, in a sense, the GNA was left with only a single choice. And in that context, in November 2019, the GNA didn't have much choice but to sign a deal with Ankara. So the short term, these kinds of internal EU divisions that are opening up, driving a sort of sense in Rome and Valletta to sort of try to sort of decouple this a bit, to sort of say, all right, we disagree with your deal, this MOU with the GNA. We are going to back Greece and Cyprus robustly when it comes to the specifics of Crete and Cyprus, which the Italians actually have. But when it comes to the specifics of what's happening on the ground of Libya, we're going to try and decouple these things a bit, because actually Rome's interests align more with the GNA than they align with France's support for the LNA. So in the very short term, this gives an advantage in the particular Libyan space, that whatever confrontations you have, say, between the French and Turkish ships, it's worth noting that actually the Italian naval presence around West Libya is more substantial, and the Italians are, surprise, surprise, not getting in the way of any Turkish naval transport efforts. They're not I mean, there's a few interceptions by the Guardia di Finanza and so on, but on the broader terms, the Italians could be doing much more to blocking what the Turks are doing in Libya, and they're not. And so I think that's a problem that is presented, that France has actually kind of assumed that it would receive a level of backing from EU partners that it's not, in terms of France's particular version of Libya policy. And traditionally, the Libya file has always, before the 2011 war, the fall of Gaddafi, the Libya file was traditionally always something that the Italians dealt with. So on the EU level, and particularly with the issues of border control that open up. So, I mean, these kinds of tensions that you have, they're not as bad as they were maybe a few years ago between Rome and Paris. I mean, both sides are trying to sort of find a relatively civil way of working these differences out within EU institutions. But it still comes down to the fact that the Italians have different interests.
Okay. Let's say this Italian and Maltese view were to gain ground in the EU, and that Turkey were to some extent be allowed to do what it wants in Libya in terms of that Libyan intervention, but not in the Eastern Mediterranean. Yeah. What would that look like? What would the EU do about what Turkey is doing in the Eastern Mediterranean?
I think, you see, this is where I wonder about Turkey's long-term position. If Turkey had, I mean, Turkey does in the Turkish Ministry of Foreign Affairs and around Akar and the Ministry of Defense does have some very sharp strategists and has some very sharp, still, despite all the purges and all the people who have had to leave since 2016, mm-hmm. there's still a lot of smart people in the Turkish bureaucracy. Now, if they were running things, if they were the final deciders, there is a pathway for Turkey to sort of work on these kinds of internal tensions within the EU structures and at some point make an offer or open up to serious negotiations directly with the Greeks and Cypriots, which would sort of, you know, open up a pathway. They wouldn't necessarily be to terms that Greece or Cyprus would accept, but open up enough of a pathway to dialogue that somebody in Rome or somebody in Malta or other states like the Spanish, Repsol also has substantial interests in southern Libya as the one of the main Spanish oil and gas firms. And you know, and they're not necessarily very happy about UAE or Russia or Egypt playing a too big a role in the parts of those parts of Libya where Repsol has interests, where the Spanish companies have interests. So it could open up on these divisions, at least sort of try to build a better negotiating position for itself. Because in the end, the East Med dispute will have to be negotiated, right? There's no way Turkey is going to actually extract substantial amounts of gas and build the gas pipeline infrastructure and get the financing without some kind of deal with the Greeks, Cypriots, and the EU. I mean, a lot of what it's doing, if you look at it in terms of long-term strategy, is building up as advantageous a negotiation position as it can for itself. But if you look at the certain kind of mindset of the very top of the Turkish leadership, you can see a situation emerging where actually Turkey builds up a relatively okay advantageous negotiating position but doesn't then follow through on the what is needed diplomatically to build a kind of off-ramp for the EU side, build a potential basis for dialogue with Cyprus and Greece that could then lead to an outcome which all sides benefit from.
You're saying that Turkey could in a way like lose all this ground that it's gained if it's not careful now.
If it's not careful now, I mean, it has gained ground. I mean, that's what, as I said, I mean, when we spoke last time about the Libyan case, I didn't think the LNA had, I mean, I think a lot of people overestimated the ability of LNA and the Russian mercenaries that it was using or backing, its Russian, UAE, and Egyptian backers to really gain Tripoli. I think that was overestimated. I think what Turkey had put in was enough to stop that. And then I thought at some point, you know, there would be a stalemate on the ground and it would lead to negotiations. Now, you know, what surprised me and a lot of people, observers, was actually not just that the Turks were able to sort of enforce a stalemate, but that they were actually able to push the LNA back so far, which showed a lot of internal weaknesses within the LNA structure, within the people, the whole coalition of factions around Haftar, that showed the limits of what you could do with the Russian mercenaries. I don't think you can blame Wagner, the Russian mercenary structure, the Russian state support structure, for what happened. They were just trying to sort of deal with a situation that had already become impossible and did their best. And in fact, in many ways, the withdrawal for Russian and Egyptian interests makes a lot of sense. I mean, in a sense, the Russians and Egyptians can now entrench their influence on in eastern Libya and still box the Turks and the GNA into what is mostly western Libya and keep them out of a large parts of the rest of the country. That's still not a bad position for the LNA or the Russians or the Egyptians to be in. I think it's more of a problem for UAE, which has always had a maximalist view of its goals in Libya. Its UAE seems least inclined to look for some sort of negotiated outcome. But it then comes down to Turkey. Is Turkey willing to then sit down and use the kind of advantages it's built up to then follow a pathway through to some negotiated settlement, which will require compromises, will require approaching Athens and Nicosia, and will require some kind of form of reestablishment of dialogue, which is, the Turks can probably do from a better position. Because the problem is, if the Turks wait too long, domestic instability, internal economic instability in Turkey, a potential lira crisis, a potential situation where the economic foundations of the Turkish geopolitical position, which are actually quite weak, catch up with Erdogan and the AKP leadership, and then undermine their ability to use these advantages if they have to then turn to the EU and require economic assistance or assistance from the IMF at a wider level.
Now to another long-running Turkey-EU issue, which actually also points to Turkish domestic instability, refugees and migration. Yeah. Greece and the EU are facing calls to probe the death of a Syrian man at the Turkish border after a report by London-based research group Forensics Architecture concluded it was, quote, highly probable he was shot by Greek soldiers. Mohammed Al-Arab, a 22-year-old man from Aleppo, was killed in March as he joined the thousands or tens of thousands of migrants seeking to enter Greece after Turkey followed through on President Erdogan's threat to, quote, open the gates to Europe. Athens has rejected accusations of using live fire, and many analysts have accused Turkey of weaponizing refugees in order to pressure Europe into providing greater funding for the 3.5 million Syrian refugees already in Turkey, or to come to Turkey's aid in Syria's Idlib province, where some 2 million displaced people are living in ad hoc camps along Turkey's border. The European Parliament is holding a hearing today, Monday, on the EU's immigration policy and is supposed to quiz the Greek government on the deaths of Al-Arab and a Pakistani man as well. What's your view of all this? Is Turkey to blame? Is Greece to blame for these incidents at the border, or both of them? And should the EU change its immigration policies? And if so, how?
I think sometimes it's too much of a cop-out to say all sides are to blame. But in this situation, when it comes to, you know, the way in which both Turkish and EU border and refugee policy have evolved, all sides are to blame. I mean, I think that situation was both a failed attempt actually by Erdogan to put the EU under pressure by threatening, which turned out to be more of a bluff than anything else, but threatening the EU with a refugee wave. So that was an irresponsible act, which proved, I think, was actually probably diplomatically and politically unnecessary in that context, particularly since Turkey actually managed to get a very swift grip on the situation in Idlib itself by demonstrating a robust use of force. And also in the Idlib context, actually demonstrating the limits to how far Russia is really willing to go to back Assad's maximalist aims. That's a different story, the different issue. So I think, I mean, first of all, the Erdogan misused refugees and in a sense did something openly, which he might have done more tacitly in 2015, maybe did even more effectively in 2015 for Turkey's interest by not shouting so loudly about it, but just letting things run their course in 2015. I think the second thing is that Greece, I mean, you have this ongoing paranoia within Greek politics about having to face a second wave like in 2015 and a deep fear. And what you've had is the more authoritarian elements within Greece, policing and border guard structures and the military also have come to believe that this is, you know, also some sort of deep Turkish plot or goal to undermine Greek statehood and Greece's position in the EU. So you have an atmosphere which is, I think, toxic within parts of the Greek bureaucracy. That
we should mention, however, that EU officials have largely supported that view.
Yeah, no, I was going to get to that. I mean, I think this is the thing. I mean, you have a toxic atmosphere within the Greek context. Not throughout. I mean, there are very many professional Greek military people, very many professional Greek military officers, very many professional Greek policemen, border guard people who themselves are a little bit sketchy, you know, and are not automatically people are going to go out and shoot people. I mean, but unfortunately, their voices were not necessarily the ones being heard at that moment in time. And that's an opportunity for the EU either to come in and say, you know, to a member state through an institution like Frontex, which is increasingly centralizing control of border management and border security throughout the Schengen area and throughout even parts of the EU beyond it. Which that's the Frontex is the EU's border control and border management institutional organization whose power is rapidly expanding. It could have either, you know, had option one would have been to go in and say calm down the Greeks and sort of assist in terms of robustly defending the borders, but also ensuring that it's done within a kind of human rights framework that lives up to EU's sort of theoretical aspirations in terms of a different form of statehood. Or in the second case, and that's the option that they chose, the fallback in the EU Commission under Ursula von der Leyen, you go in and robustly demonstrate to Greek and other EU voters that no, this time we're serious about controlling the borders, and you can trust you can trust a system that opens up borders within the EU because the borders outside of the EU's Schengen area will be robustly enforced with lethal force. And, I mean, in the end, they went for option B, again, because of the kind of political traumas and experiences of 2015 and the fears of the rise of populism or the way it might feel for pure populism. But that meant that, in a sense, the EU didn't just tacitly back the use of maximum force against potentially refugee entrances. They actually even praised it to a certain extent, not the actual shootings. I mean, obviously that created a degree of a step back and a bit of shock on the EU side as well. But they up to that point, you know, you even had the EU side describing Greece and Greece's military and border forces as the EU's shield against the misuse of refugees for geopolitical purposes, I think is the way in which Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the EU Commission, phrased it. So in the end, the EU leadership and most EU membership states went for option B out of a deep fear of sort of not just the refugee wave, but the kind of potential populist destabilization by anti-EU populist parties in the EU member states that may emerge afterwards. And that again sort of led to a ton of tasks that then just sort of tacitly back what the Greeks were doing. It sort of encouraged it almost to the extent to which excessive force was used. But remember also in those situations, there was also indications of Turkish irresponsible behavior by Turkish border police and Turkish police and troops on the border in terms of waving firearms about. You know, it was a really nasty situation in which all sides were at fault. What does this say about EU border policy? It says in the short term, we're going to see a militarization of EU border policy. You know, Frontex, the central agency for managing the borders, is getting over the next decade 10,000 of its own personnel. I think they'll actually expand to something substantially larger. It'll be the first armed force, more or less armed force, under central EU control. And it's designed to be a kind of flying mobile reserve that supports the border guards of EU member states and actually has substantial control over what the border guards of EU member states do that are along the EU's collective borders, in particular the base structured around the internal borderless Schengen area within the EU. And that's also, I think, a worrying sign that this agency is going to be the first EU substantial security agency that isn't just about coordinating policing or high-level investigation. You're also seeing something parallel in emergence of the European Public Prosecutor's Office, which is the first kind of a European prosecutorial judicial body, first, you know, law enforcement body built, and the expansion of Europol. But I think in terms of Frontex, the worrying thing is that this is an institution that's anchored in the notion that for the EU to survive, you need to militarize its borders and use force to support various, you know, stabilization operations, which is a euphemism for quasi-military action, to sort of fortify and protect the EU's borders. I don't think that's necessarily a desirable long-term outcome for the EU. I think a more desirable and more sustainable EU migration policy is one that works together with neighboring states and gradually finds ways of integrating neighboring states into the EU system in ways in which creates, you know, a more managed flow of migration, through also opening up the EU a little bit more to the labor migration that it needs, and also in terms of increasing prosperity and legal access through integration of countries like Turkey, Tunisia, Algeria into the EU, maybe even Libya eventually, God knows, sometime long in the future, or Morocco into the EU's system, as Ukraine has been. Ukraine, for example, isn't a member of the EU, but through the Deep and Comprehensive Free Trade Agreement and the Association Agreement, Ukraine is part of the EU system, which gives Ukrainians not full Schengen access, but substantial access to Schengen, and the Ukrainian economy substantial access to Schengen. And that actually creates that. The paradox is that actually the more you reduce border controls, the more you can, and the more you create, develop shared frameworks and shared regulatory structures and shared ways of managing and steering labor throughout this kind of wider zone, and the more you increase prosperity in states along the EU's borders, actually the more migration actually after initial surge tends to stabilize. But I fear that, you know, whereas Ukraine and Tunisia are being treated along that kind of basis, I don't think Turkey is going to see that kind of approach anytime soon, because of other diplomatic issues that we've already referred to, and an underlying distrust of where the AKP is taking Turkey.
Right. Speaking of that, today, EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell is in Ankara, and he just minutes ago held a joint press conference with Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu. One of the issues under discussion was travel. About, I think, 10 days ago now, the European Council announced the non-EU countries from which the EU would welcome travelers as of July 1st, and Turkey was shocked to be left off that list, arguing that its coronavirus cases had fallen considerably and that it had performed better than some countries that made the list. What's your view about this? Does Turkey have a legitimate beef, or is this another sign of the EU's supposed anti-Erdogan, anti-Muslim bias?
I think if you took it along those lines, I think I don't think this is about anti-Muslim bias. I think on a more macro level, not necessarily about these particular travel liberalizations, but if you look at EU's relations with Tunisia, and Tunisia is very much treated by the EU as like a potential, not a member state, but a potential sort of EEA, eventual single market member. I mean, so, you know.
That's interesting let me just mention that, like, just a few years ago, Tunisia was led by an Islamist party.
Yeah, but in Ennahda, you know, the thing about that party, Ennahda, is that those around it have very cannily built relationships with European Christian Democratic parties in a way that the AKP once did 15 years ago. This is now forgotten, the extent to which the old, you know, the pre-coup AKP, even the pre-2008 AKP, the pre-Ergenekon AKP, was actually did a lot to sort of court European Christian Democratic parties and conservative parties and present itself as, you know, look, we're actually just sort of basically like you, you know, sort of a Christian Democratic, Islamic variant of a Christian Democratic party. And I mean, you'd have AKP figures in Germany citing Adenauer. You know, and it was, and again, many of the figures who did this are now no longer in the AKP, right? So that's actually says a lot about the AKP's development over time. But in this kind of wider context, this is about a number of different things. So Nahda, for example, the Tunisian party has, I think, in a much more genuine internal development, sort of courted the EU on that kind of level. And there's actually a very strong secular for, you know, more socialist trade union forces in Tunisia that developed this. So I think this notion of anti-Muslim bias, I mean, you have to look at how the EU deals with other states around its borders. And there is a degree of anti-Muslim bias in some of what the EU does, but I don't think it's as systemic as many on the AKP side now claim. In terms of these specific travel restrictions, I think it's partly yes. This partly, I think, particularly driven by France, a suspicion of Turkey as a whole. But I think there's also a much more systemic problem in that people don't necessarily, within the EU Commission, don't necessarily trust Turkey's figures on COVID-19. And that may be unfair. So, I mean, that may be a little bit unfair towards the Turkish state at this point, but there was an early phase of the COVID-19 crisis where, you know, the responses of the Turkish state were quite slapdash or quite sort of unwilling to admit there was a crisis on. And there's also a more fundamental problem in terms of post the 2016 coup, but also actually post really 2012, 2013, post Gezi, among some EU states, post Ergenekon, there was a kind of a distrust of the information supplied to them by Turkish state institutions and a distrust of the figures. And of course, this also comes back to a background of a breakdown of trust between the EU member states, the EU institutions, and the Turkish state, and particularly the AKP leadership. But that then means that when you have to make decisions on an EU side about who you're going to open up to in a moment of crisis such as COVID-19, you're going to open up to states who you trust. Right, in states whose state institutions you trust, with which you have like a daily flow of communication. This hasn't really happened yet for Tunisia, but Tunisia, you have that daily flow of communication, right? And I think that puts the Tunisians, it's remarkably, if you think about where Turkey and Tunisia were for 20 years ago, that puts Tunisia in a much, much better position in relation to the EU than it does Turkey. If I'd said this to somebody coming from 2000, they would have thought it was a mad thing to say, but it's remarkable that there's this kind of change in the trajectories between Tunisia and Turkey. Whereas in the Turkish case, you know, they don't trust that if you don't trust what the Turkish side is telling you, then you're going to go safety first and not, you know, open up to Turkey as quickly as to say the Turkish state wants.
Right. Speaking of the states that EU trusts, last week, German auto giant Volkswagen scrapped plans to build a 1.3 billion euro car factory in Turkey's Manisa province, citing a slump in demand caused by the coronavirus pandemic. This move came about 8 months after Volkswagen halted the project because of Turkey's Syria offensive against Kurdish militants allied with the United States. Erdogan had reportedly become personally involved in the effort to persuade Volkswagen to stay, offering incentives and tax breaks. So the loss of this factory and its 4,000 or so jobs amid an already troubled economy must be a tough blow. What's the view in Germany of all this and at Volkswagen? Was this really because of the pandemic, or did it have something to do with Turkey's democratic backsliding?
I think a whole number of different factors kind of converged on that. I mean, I found an interesting decision, partly because, well, you know, I personally, I grew up in Hannover, which is just off Wolfsburg. I mean, those are the two main HQs of Volkswagen. So mm-hmm. I grew up in a city that lives and breathes the German car industry. And I have, you know, just knowing the kind of Volkswagen mentality, it's the people who run it, it's very much safety first. Right. And to get Volkswagen, I mean, it was remarkable that the Turkish state was able to get Volkswagen to invest because, I mean, VW is extremely careful about the kind of investment decisions it makes. And the fact that it was still willing to take these risks in the Turkish market after 2016 showed a number of things that, you know, it already has a substantial supply chain in Turkey, which is cemented by the Europe EU Turkey's customs union with the EU. It shows how important that customs union is with the EU, and also understandably why Turkey wants to renegotiate it to sort of expand those kinds of advantages. But it also, you know, as these kind of issues evolved, what you again see is again, Volkswagen is intertwined with the German state. On a regional level, the governments of Lower Saxony, you know, in Germany, of course, regional governments are very powerful within the German system. The government of Lower Saxony has a 25%, I think it's a bit lower now, 21.3%, I think, stake. I'll probably get corrected online about that. But it has over 20% stake in Volkswagen. So the trade unions play a huge role in organizing Volkswagen, in helping to co-manage Volkswagen. So it's very politically sensitive as well as a company. So, I mean, with Turkey's deteriorating reputation, with a growing sense of internal instability in Turkey, with a sense also among VW managers that, you know, they don't necessarily trust the rule of law, you also have people of Turkish origin and Turkish background as managers and as trade union figures. You also have people of Turkish and Kurdish origin as managers and trade union figures in Volkswagen. Volkswagen, not at the very senior level, but at a sort of middle management level, at the trade union level, has been has done quite well on that front. You know, many are, you know, come from a political tradition that isn't necessarily friendly to the AKP. You know, you've got a whole set of factors already that, you know, meant that project was already running a little bit against headwinds. And Izmir actually is also a CHP region, so there was also a degree of sense that, you know, these are local politicians we can work with. So then you have, you know, the decisions surrounding the Turkish invasion of another part of northern Syria, Tel Abyad, the attacks on the YPG. And then you now have a COVID-19 situation, which is also what we've seen is an erosion of trust on the state level, then impacts the way in which corporations begin to see whether they can trust the Turkish state as well. And because VW is so intertwined with the regional and federal German state, you know, you have basically a corporation that can pretty well pick up a lot of the information the German regional and national state are getting about developments in Turkey. So I think that the project already looked sketchy before the initial suspension in November. And then, you know, because of the COVID-19 situation, it was going to be the first thing that VW cuts to save money. You know, once that had been suspended, it was always going to be exposed to the first major crisis. So with the COVID-19 situation, it was obviously going to be, because not a lot of money had been invested into it, it was going to be the first thing that was canceled. Also worth keeping in mind that the Bulgarians were very, very quick after the initial suspension to get on the line to Wolfsburg, I think even the Bulgarian prime minister personally. And that was also a good old sign that, you know, Turkey sees the Bulgarian leadership as an EU member state with which it has a very friendly relationship. But when it comes down to investment from a German corporation, that's when friendship ends. And the Bulgarians were also quite ruthless and seeing that opportunity and trying to get that investment to a lesser extent pointed towards maybe Varna or another major Bulgarian industrial center.
Okay, now to one last emerging Turkey-EU issue, religion. 2 weeks ago, the Dutch parliament published a report finding that Turkey's Directorate of Religious Affairs, or DNEP, had been using fear, intimidation, and threats to influence people of Turkish origin in the Netherlands in an effort to perpetuate a Turkish vision of Islam. Then last week, Belgium's state security services published its annual report, which listed the Islamism of Turkey's AKP and Erdogan as one of the country's primary threats, and again named the DNEP as the main problematic actor. These reports are in addition to repeated accusations by the German and Austrian governments that Turkey and the DNEP have used mosques and imams in their countries for spying and for promoting radical Islam. So here we've got at least four European states essentially arguing that Turkey is to some extent violating their sovereignty, looking to influence and intimidate their citizenry and push a particular religious vision. Do you think these concerns are valid or overblown? And if they are valid, what might EU states or the EU do about it?
Well, I mean, the Turkish state has been instrumentalizing DNEP since the early 1980s. I mean, it depends on which Turkish government you're looking at, but each Turkish government has tried to use DNEP to influence the Turkish diaspora, which has grown to such a substantial factor both in European public and political life, as well as to a substantial extent also in Turkish public and political life. I mean, I'm a historian, so it's along with the Algerians, Ukrainians, Libyans, Syrians, and Croatians, it's the Turkish and Kurdish communities, one of the communities I look at in a kind of comparative perspective in terms of diasporas in Europe and the relationship between EU and Turkey and the EU and its other neighboring states. And, you know, if you go into the archives, you'll find tons and tons of files of German politicians on a local level and German police officers, intelligence services, German national politicians in the early 1980s complaining about how the Turkish government is trying to influence Turkish religious life or Turkish diaspora religious life in Turkey. And it's a sort of an on and on again, off again kind of relationship. When Turkey's interests align with those of the EU member states, all of this spying and all of this pressure and all of this kind of ideological, you know, problematic ideological frameworks in which many, not all, I mean, there's some really good Diyanet imams on a personal level. You know, it's not the whole structure. I mean, but all the structure often is easily pressured by the Turkish state through Diyanet. You know, a lot, you know, all of this stuff is ignored. And then when you have a divergence of interests, you have a kind of a debate about whether this is really sustainable. I think it's gotten worse simply because I can't remember Turkish European EU relations being as bad as this in the last 20 years, at least the last 20 years that I've been doing this. So of course, I think in that sense, these claims are more serious. I think the other threat to Diyanet's position isn't necessarily that this might be the straw that breaks the camel's back after two or three decades of this sort of thing under successive Turkish governments. I think the other threat to Diyanet's position is actually what you now have is not just a first.
Wait, just second, sorry, before you get to that, yeah. I just want to ask, you said this has been going on since at least the 1980s. Do you not think it's any worse, any more intense today?
I think if you asked a member of the Turkish diaspora who was left-leaning in, say, 1983, 1984, West Germany or France.
When the Kurdish conflict began.
When the Kurdish conflict began, Kenan Evren and the mass arrest or mass, the evisceration of the Turkish left. Remember, substantial parts, you could almost say the Turkish left is stronger in Germany than it is in Turkey, because substantial parts of the, and a lot of that Turkish left legacy is now flown into the German Green Party and parts of the Social Democratic Party and Linke. You have substantial numbers of people fleeing.
And today you could say the same thing about the Gulen movement.
Yeah, I think the Gulen movement, although actually the Gulen movement encounters much more resistance within diaspora communities, because actually it was the left that flees first. The influence of the remnants of the Turkish left, or its legacies, are much more present. And in a sense, actually also mean that there are a lot of people who don't take, you know, I think the Gulen movement will find it more difficult. But yeah, it lives abroad. It lives in the diaspora in a way which can't live in Turkey. But sort of in this kind of wider context, it's sort of a kind of a recurring factor in development. I think it has gotten worse than it has been under an AKP government in Ankara, right? It has gotten a lot worse. But actually, that's one of the things that leads to potential that actually, in that sense, again, it's a sign of Ankara risks taking advantage and overplaying its hand. It was already visible during the constitutional referendum, when you had all of this activity across the diaspora, that actually they were kind of overplaying their hand and pushing a lot of people that were actually relatively open-minded towards Ankara to at least a much more skeptical position within Diyanet, within DT, which is the German kind of affiliate of Diyanet, or within Belgian or French or Dutch affiliates of Diyanet. You had people within religious structures saying, hold on a minute, is it really a good idea for our interest as a religious organization or religious communities or a religious community in a local city level to do this. And on top of that, we're not talking anymore about just a first or second generation. There's a third or even a fourth generation of people growing up, you know, with a strong family and emotional relationship to Turkey, but their entire frames of reference are German or Dutch or Belgian. And yet they're imams in parts of these communities and deeply engaged. So it kind of, in that kind of environment, you know, you have, Turkey is not just, I think the real threat to Diyanet's position in Europe isn't so much state action, although I think it's more likely now than it has been in the last two decades. The real threat is that substantial parts of the diasporas themselves look around and say, my grandparents came from Turkey. You know, I may be a devout Muslim, but my grandparents came to Turkey. Maybe my frame of reference will be more a kind of a more indigenous, increasingly indigenous German Muslim tradition, right, which has its roots in Turkey. But actually increasingly reflects the German political and social environment, and is increasingly contains imams and theologians and figures entirely trained in Germany. You know, well, that might break the influence of the Turkish state over German religious Muslim religious life in Germany far more than anything that the German state does.
It's really interesting that you say that. I did a podcast a couple of weeks ago with a Swedish analyst who pointed out how the AKP had quietly begun backing pro-Muslim political parties in Europe, pointing to Sweden's Nuance Party and to the Netherlands' Denk Party, both of which are run by politicians of Turkish origin and are seen as linked to the AKP. He suggested that Turkey hoped to build a sort of Europe-wide network of successful pro-Muslim parties as a way to not only increase its influence over the Turkish diaspora, but to even influence policies in EU states or at least cities. What do you think of this? Have you seen any of this?
I don't. I mean, they're trying. I mean, there's an organization in Europe called the UETD, the Union of European Turkish, Democrats, and it's very much built along the AIPAC model, the AIPAC model, which is the kind of one of those Israeli lobbying pro-Israel lobbying organization in the United States, or also paradoxically, it has a lot of similarities to pro-Armenian organizations in Europe and the United States, who are extremely successful, or pro-Ukrainian organizations, also one of the most politically effective diasporas globally are the Ukrainians.
Well, but those are lobbying groups, not political parties.
Political parties, but I mean, if you look at the way in which they influence or force, endorsement decisions in Canadian and U.S. politics, you don't cross them. I think the problem with UETD is and these kinds of underlying plans is that, again, they often sort of – it's not – they don't really adapt properly to the domestic political style. And I think that there's a genuine – I think the AKP is trying this. But, there's only so far you can push these kinds of policies and parties before they begin to run up against substantial resistance within, not just within the domestic political scene, but within the domestic diaspora scene. And that's, I think, comes back to the core problem of these kinds of AKP projects. Is the AKP viewing the diaspora has traditionally seen the diaspora, the Turkish diaspora in Europe, as being far more homogeneous than it actually is. I mean, if you look at the actual diaspora in Germany or the Netherlands in itself, like you'll have a kind of substantial minority, a substantial group of people within it that are pro AKP, not just sort of willing to vote. I mean, you have many more people willing to sort of maybe vote for Erdogan or support Erdogan, say Erdogan's a great guy. But if you break it down in terms of people actually affiliated with the UETD and engaged in actual political and diaspora activity, that's not the majority. And you have a substantial minority within these communities that leans to the left. And the AKP, what the AKP tends to do in the way in which, the very clumsy way in which it engages with the diaspora, is it doesn't so much generate the unity it needs to become an effective political force. What it tends to do is come in and be far too forceful. And in many ways, it assumes that you can deal with a diaspora in the same way that you deal with a provincial AKP setup in Turkey, right? That you can just have a clear power vertical, a line of command, the people locally will do what you want. The problem is the AKP simply hasn't got the same coercive means to control what a diaspora does that it does within its own state environment. So, I mean, look, the thing about the effectiveness of Israeli lobbying in the United States, for example, or the effectiveness of Ukrainian lobbying in Canada and the United States and parts of Europe, or Armenian lobbying, is that these lobbying efforts are bipartisan from within Armenia, or from within Israel. And actually, one of the reasons why this Israeli lobbying efforts have begun to fray and fall apart in the States, at least, is that they increasingly are seen to reflect the concerns of Likud rather than the wider Israeli political scene. Same goes for the Turkish attempt to sort of build these structures in Europe by making them too much overtly of an AKP structure. Yeah, so you may get, 15-20% of the Turkish diaspora behind you, but in the end, what that does is actually open up divisions within diaspora communities, which means that they go at war with each other, with themselves, and means that in terms of as a united force, they're far less able to act as a united force in the interests of your society or your government or your party towards the German government. Because what tends to happen is when one of these AKP diaspora initiatives really becomes confrontational, the first people to resist it are other Turkish-German politicians, right? Ones that come from the CHP or the HDP traditions or the Turkish left traditions, people like Cem Özdemir, who's still a deeply influential politician on the German political scene, but profoundly opposed to the AKP. Like the moment the AKP sends in somebody like Fatih Zingal or others to make a big deal in German politics, the first people that face them are other Turkish German politicians are saying, no, you guys are actually enemies of Turkey's true strategic interests. So that it's not. It's they're trying to emulate a kind of diaspora influence strategy without realizing that it only really works if you have all kind of parties within Turkey and social movements, a broad range of social movements in Turkey, kind of backing it and supporting it. If you try to do it as a purely partisan party political strategy, it tends to fall apart because it simply just exports the same fractures and fissures that you have within Turkish society into the diaspora.
Mm. And it seems like maybe the more Turkey pushes this agenda, the more people are going to turn away, as is happening now in Turkey.
Yeah. And also, again, it's much easier to turn away in the diaspora. I mean, every person of migrant background has the right to not be interested in their migrant background. So turning away can be a number of different things. Turning away can be engagement in anti-AKP movements, or it can be a lot of people saying, I'm sort of like of Turkish origin, but actually I grew up in Mannheim and I feel more German or feel more Dutch and whatever. And a lot of that is underreported, I think. There's a substantial part of the Turkish diaspora that's still kind of like, yeah, it's nice to go on holiday to meet my cousin, but, politics, who cares? And I think that's because that's not so a dynamic thing for Twitter or social media, the reality, a much more kind of ambiguous and complex social reality where these kinds of measures just actually put people off their country of origin. I think a lot of that is sort of not understood, but it's very much a part of a much more mundane and everyday life in Germany or Dutch or Belgian society, where substantial parts of diaspora are just like, yeah, okay, I'll listen to an Ivo Tatlises record and then I'll just go and play golf and that's it when it comes to my Turkish identity.
Alexander Clarkson of King's College London, we've gone way over our time yet again.
No problem, sir.
Thanks so much for your time and insight. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Bye.
You can follow Ahval News online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.